assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Stavadale. Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pacharne Nivasesis Nivane Pascacharya Satarne Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Chapadakamam Sri Guru and Vaishnavascha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitham Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Sri Vishakam Vitham Sha Panchakalpa Chubhishchanki Pasindhya Vitham Tichanam Pavane Yodhaya Sri. So today is October 30th, 2014 in Ljubljana, and Ananta Prabhu asked me to speak today about Gopastami, which is tomorrow, and about Govardhan Hill. Gopastami is the day that Krishna and Balaram stop taking care of the calves, and start taking care of the cows. Now, if we think about this particular activity and this particular day in terms of modern society, then it's quite odd, because it's also the day when Krishna and Balaram are about 6 years old. So this means that before they were 6 years old, they were taking care of the calves. So it means if you think about a child, like how old is this child right there? How old is that child? Six? Okay, so would you send him out in the forest all day to take care of big grown cows? Would you do that? Would you let him go out in the forest without any adults for the whole day to take care of cows? No, I don't think so. Right, and think of that when Krishna and Balaram were younger, they were also going to the forest all day taking care of the calves. I mean, again, would you send a 4 or 5 year old child, group of young children? You know, Balaram was taking care of Krishna, but he's not that much older. It's not like Balaram's 12 or something. He's around the same age. You know, Balaram, please take care of your younger brother, but he's just a little boy too, so. And please don't think that, well, this is just Krishna and Balaram are God and that's why they're doing this. But this was the socially accepted behavior at the time. And we still see this in many parts of the world where very young children, 3, 4, 5 year old children, take a lot of responsibility. But in our modern, you know, developed countries, this would be considered practically abusive, wouldn't it? If you had your 4 year old child go into the forest for the whole day, you know, like 10 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, watching the calves. Now, of course, they were also playing when they were watching the calves, or later when they were watching the cows. But you have to think, too, in the forest there was a river. It was a big river. There's no adults there at all. You know, there's a big river. And then there's, you know, rocky mountain of Govardhan. And then there's all these evil wizards. You know, from our modern perspective, that's something out of a fantasy book or movie. You know, or something out of the old fairy tales, that the children are afraid to go in the forest because there's evil shape-shifting wizards in the forest, but indeed there were. And we can understand that these stories that are still existent in our society, the fairy tales, and all that, they're based on something. That was actually existing on the planet at that time. But, you know, if you think about it, what parent would let their 4-year-old child into a forest? And there were tigers there also. Tigers and lions. And even at the time of the Goswamis, there were tigers in the Vrindavan forest, even just 500 years ago. So, you know, wild, carnivorous beasts, shape-shifting wizards that could assume forms, you know, huge forms. Putana was 12 miles. How many kilometers is 12 miles? How many kilometers is that? Kilometer is 6/10 of a mile. So 12 miles is how many kilometers?
18.
18, okay. So 18-kilometer-long big witch, and Agasura, I think, was just as long, maybe longer. Right? I mean, there was evidence that there were these wizards in the forest, these demons in the forest with magical powers, because Agasura's dead body was there, and Putana's dead body was there. I mean, Krishna would say to his mother, no, mother, it's just rumors. You know, don't be worried that there's these demons. But there were these demons. So the whole thing is very extraordinary from our modern perspective. We really can't even fathom this. I mean, just recently in America, there was one mother who was arrested because she let her 9-year-old daughter play in the local playground without adult supervision. And she was arrested for child neglect. I mean, I remember when I was 12 or so, I could ride my bicycle 5 miles, 10 miles on my own. But again, the idea of giving a young child that much responsibility, but that was what it was like. It was very much like that. This concept we have in our modern society that children should have no responsibility until they finish college. The only thing they should do until they're 22 years old. And now you have to get a master's degree too, so now it's like 25 maybe. So the only thing you do until you're 22 or 25 years old is you just go to school and play. You know, and the children even feel very entitled that, well, I finished my schoolwork now, you know, I should just be allowed to play. And if you ask them to do anything, they're resentful. Oh, you're asking me to do some work. But these children, 4 or 5 years old, and they're doing 5 or 6 hours of work every day. Of course, it was not all work. They were just playing. But and also the cows are also dangerous. They're dangerous animals. They have horns. Yes, the cows have horns. And even the little baby calves are somewhat dangerous. I mean, they have hard hooves, and they can kick. You know, when Krishna was very little, very, very little, just like 1 or 2 years old, he would stand up. You know, you've seen little children, they stand up by grabbing something, right? So Krishna would stand up by grabbing the tail of a calf. You know? And then the calf would become frightened. Who's grabbing my tail? And then the calf would start running everywhere, dragging this little, you know, 1-2-year-old child through the muddy clay and the cow dung. And nobody got worried. They just laughed. You know, the older gopis, and they would just laugh. Oh, just look at this one, you know, that Krishna's having with the cows. So this is, I mean, again, from the point of view of Leela, but it isn't just that it's Leela. This was the society at that time. It wasn't that this behavior was completely outrageous for the society. So I find that very interesting from a sociological point of view. But from a Leela point of view, it's also very interesting that God takes care of cows. Yeah, that is quite interesting. So as a little boy, he's taking care of the calves, and then tomorrow on Gopastami was the ceremony where he was starting to take care of the cows. That was his job, starting at 6 years old. Of course, Krishna did go to school, but he didn't go to school while he was in Vrindavan. He didn't go to school until he went to Mathura. And then Vasudev said, you know, you need an education. And so he was initiated by Garbhacharya, and then he went to the school of Sandipani Muni. Of course, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that he doesn't have anything to do. He says, there's no work for me in this world. But he tells Arjuna, if I didn't come and work, then all the worlds would be put to ruination and I would be the cause of unwanted population. And that statement is in response to Arjuna's point that he said, if I fight this war, all these men will be killed. So in those days, generally, women didn't fight on the battlefield. Well, sometimes. Kaikei drove her husband's chariot when he was injured in battle. But generally speaking, the women were not combatants. Sometimes. There are some stories in Indian history of women who were actually on the battlefield. But generally, it was the men that who were fighting. And so Arjuna said, when we kill all these men are somebody's father and somebody's husband. These women, somebody's son, and these women will be left without anyone to take care of them. You know, sociologically speaking, if you have a certain percentage, I think it's 17%, of unprotected women in society, you start having chaos. You know, society starts to fall apart. So, of course, that is our situation now in almost all of the world. And Arjuna said, when this happens, there'll be Varna Sankara. Varna Sankara literally means children when you don't know who the father is. You don't know what their varna is. You don't know what their social position is. And what we would probably call illegitimate children, children born out of marriage. He said there'll be all these varna sankara because the women will not be taken care of anymore. Society will crumble. And Krishna's response is, no, it's not that war will cause illegitimate children, but running away from your duty will cause illegitimate children. And we see that practically speaking. We see that the reason that there are so many children now born out of marriage or so many divorces also is people don't want to do their duty. So the sociological statistics is that about 2/3 of divorces are just because people are, they're not happy. You know, 1/3 is for serious reasons, abuse or something like that. But 2/3, it's actually just, someone says, I'm just not fulfilled. I just don't like this person anymore. You know, I used to like them and now I don't, and I'm just not happy and I want to find somebody else or I want to be free. And then the children become so disturbed. So the cause of that is thinking, I don't need to do my duty. I can just do whatever pleases me at the moment, which is very much the mode of ignorance. The mode of ignorance is, let me do whatever pleases me at the moment, never mind what the consequences are. So Krishna says, I come to do my duty in the world to set an example. And he says, if I didn't do that, I would be the cause of unwanted population and the whole world would be put to ruination. So Krishna comes and shows how a person behaves in the world, and therefore he acts as a child in Vrindavan as a proper Vaishya to do his duty and take care of the cows as their livelihood. That was their livelihood, to take care of. But that's not the only reason that Krishna takes care of cows. He's not, because Krishna doesn't really need to work. Therefore, he says, janma karma chame divyam evam yoveti tatvita tatva deham punar janma naitimam eti sorjana. He says, if you know the real mystery behind my janma and karma, janma means birth and karma means activities, then you will not take birth again. So Krishna, yes, he is taking care of the calves and the cows to set an example for human society. You should do your duty. That's a fact, he is. But that's not the only thing that's going on. Because even in the spiritual world, where there's no reason for anybody to do any duty, there's no obligation, there's no work to be done. In the spiritual world, you don't need to eat, you don't need to sleep, you don't need to have a house. You're in a spiritual body, you know, there's no hurricanes, and there's no problems in the spiritual world. You don't have a body subject to decay. Still, Krishna takes care of cows. He's an eternal cowherding boy. So he's taking care of the cows not just as a job, but because he enjoys it. It may look to the people in general, and the demons criticize Krishna for this, like Sishupal, right? Jarasandha, they criticize Krishna. Oh, you're not really a kshatriya. You're really just a village boy. You know, if you go to some big king, prince, and you say, oh, you're just a shepherd, you're just a cowherd, a little village boy, uneducated, out in the pasture, it's insult. So it's not just that Krishna was showing some work, but he really likes it. And for him, it's not really work. Krishna doesn't really work. It's not necessary. In the Bhagavatam, in the prayers of the personified Vedas, I believe it's there. It might be in the next chapter, either there or the next chapter. It's explained that Krishna is just creating this world in his sleep. Krishna's just sleeping, and this whole world is his dream. And then the Vedas say, then Krishna enters into the dream. He creates his dream and enters into it. So Krishna is creating the whole world, maintaining the whole world in his sleep. We have that expression in English. We say, oh, that's so easy, I could do it in my sleep. I don't know if you have that expression. Slovenia. You have that, yes. So easy, I can do it in my sleep. So Krishna really, truly creates and maintains and destroys the whole material world in his sleep. So he doesn't need to herd cows for a living. He can manifest the whole milk ocean just by willing it. He doesn't even need cows, huh? We never heard the milk ocean comes from cows. It's just there. An ocean of milk. And there's an ocean of ghee also. Not even just an ocean of milk, an ocean of ghee. So in many of our temples now, we don't use ghee anymore, huh? We use oil. Of course, in the old days in this kind, even we were so poor that we just slept on the floor, we always used ghee. But anyway, Krishna has an ocean of ghee and an ocean of milk, even without cows to produce them. So that's not why he's taking care of the cows, but it's simply it's fun. Krishna enjoys it. I mean, he has many pet animals. He also has buffalo, he has goats, he has dogs, he has peacocks, monkeys, deer, so many pet animals. But he particularly likes cows. You know, in our experience on this earth planet, rich people generally keep what kind of animals? Dog and? Horses. Yes, horses. So the rich aristocracy on this planet, they especially keep horses. Horses and dogs. And Krishna particularly likes cows. So again, he has so many animals. But they're his pets. And Prabhupada said that Krishna is embracing the cow and he's embracing Radharani, both. Krishna also loves his cows. So Krishna's just having fun. And really, when they're out in the forest, it's not much work. You know, occasionally, a little bit. So it says in the Bhagavatam, at the end of the day, when Krishna's bringing the cows back, that he has some japa beads. Do you know what they're made out of, Krishna's japa beads? Pearls and jewels, yes, different colored jewels. And for each bead, he calls the name of a group of cows. So there's like the Mridanga-headed cows. Do you know that? It's one of the groups of Mridanga-headed cows. You can still see there's a breed of cow in India today that looks kind of like a drumhead. Odd looking. Yeah. We have at least one photograph of them in our book. Cows Get Love. So then the red cows and the white, different groups of cows. And then the cows come and the cows are not sure what they, you know, what they want to do. Do they want to go fast? Do they want to go slow? They don't want to get too far ahead of Krishna. Right. So that's a little bit of work. You have to call the cows. Amsi. Yeah, just calling their names. But that's not much work, right? And most of the time they're just playing. So as described, the cowherd boys, they're just playing leapfrog and they're imitating the animals and they're going to the wells and they're insulting the wells. You foolish well! And then there's an echo. You foolish well. And they're laughing and they're jumping in the trees like the monkeys. And they're pretending that some of them pretend they're tigers and the other ones pretend they're deer and they run away. And then the cowherd boys really enjoy also that when Krishna kills these demons. That's their great fun. They don't take it very seriously. I mean, I would take it pretty seriously if there's an 18-kilometer snake with a mouth that's touching the sky. Wouldn't you take that kind of seriously? I'd probably start screaming, you know, and running in the other direction as fast as I could. And the cowherd boys, they just said, "Oh, what's that? Oh, is that a real snake? Or is that a statue? Well, there's a bad smell coming out of it. Ugh, smells like fish. I think it's a real snake who's been eating fish. You know what dead fish smells like. It's really awful. I say, maybe it's a big snake who's come to swallow all of us. But there's so many of us. There's thousands of us and thousands of cows. How could the snake possibly kill all of us? And anyway, Krishna's here. So let's go in and see what's in there. I mean, would you do that? Into the fishy bad smells. They didn't take it so seriously. Yeah. Oh, here's another demon. And on Gopastami, particularly, this was the day of the killing of Danika. So it was on Gopastami that as they're walking through the forest, they smell the tala fruit. And they say to Krishna and Balaram, "Oh, we are very hungry." Actually, the coward boys, they were not very hungry. But they were thinking maybe Krishna's hungry. And also they just like Krishna and Balaram to show their power. You know, that's their enjoyment, that Krishna and Balaram can show how powerful they are. So they say, "We're very hungry, and we smell some nice fruit." Just like we were in the train station in, where were we? In Budapest. And so there's one shop there that makes like cinnamon bread. You know, selling all different kinds of bread, and you smell the bread. That's their advertisement. They don't need a sign. You know, they don't need any fancy advertisement. They're just, maybe they did have a little fan there. They must have something and just spread this fragrance all over the train station. Yes, you've experienced that kind of thing, right? So it was like that with these tala fruits. They were spreading a fragrance all over Vrindavan. As the cowboy said, "Oh, we smell that. It smells so good. Can you go there?" They said, "But there's a problem. There's a problem. There's another one of these shape-shifting demons. This one looked like a big donkey. And he has a lot of donkey friends. And none of the animals won't go there. The birds won't go there. Nobody will go there." And Krishna and Balaram like, "Well, sure, we'll go. They're 6 years old. They're just 6 years old. We'll go there." So they go to the Taliban forest, and Balaram immediately just starts shaking the trees. Must be a lot of fun, huh, to be with Krishna and the coward boys. Balaram's just like, you know, and the fruit starts falling down. And when he shakes one tree, then that tree shakes another tree, and shakes another tree, and shakes another tree. And very much like when Krishna jumped into Kali's lake, you know, the demon can understand, "Hey, someone's in my place." Prabhupada talked about the immigration laws going from one country to another. He said they were like barking dogs. "Why did you come to my country? What are you going to do here? My place." It's Vrindavan. It's Krishna's place. It's not Danika's place. It's Krishna's place. And then Danika really, first of all, he's already a donkey. So that's kind of already pretty bad, you know. It's not a very attractive animal. They don't make a very attractive sound. They don't have a very beautiful form. And then he turns around and he shows his backside to Balaram. So even in the modern Malecha culture, that is considered rude. Yes?
Yes.
Even in this culture, whenever I go to India or wherever I speak to a lot of Indians, I always start off with saying, "Please excuse me, I have no culture." Because I know they won't think that American culture is culture. If I just say, "I have a different culture," they won't understand. Just say, "I have no culture." So even in our current Western civilization, where we have no culture, even we don't show our backside to people. It's insult. And if you're a donkey already, that's already bad. So you're a donkey, and then the backside of a donkey. So we will not use, we will use only polite words, but you can, in your mind, supply the other words if you like. So the donkey shows his backside to Balaram, and then he takes his back feet and he kicks Balaram. And Balaram didn't even notice. He didn't even notice. Actually, we should all be like this. We should all be like this. When the donkeys of the world show us their rear parts and kick us, we should not even pay any attention at all. just completely go about our business. And there's many people in the world who try to start an argument. Have you noticed this? And Prabhupada says this is not due to the topic, it is due to Kali Yuga. So people are arguing not because there's something to argue about. Have you ever noticed this? That a lot of what people argue about, there's no reason to argue about it? And this happens in families, among friends. It even happens in the Hare Krishna movement. Shh, don't tell anybody. So sometimes what people are arguing about, you just like kind of, you know, if you kind of move back from it for a minute and you're just wondering, why are they arguing about this? And people argue about anything. Have you noticed this? Anything. And sometimes they will argue for years. For years. And they will write 20-page papers and 30-page papers. Very seriously. They get accustomed to arguing about it. And I will fully admit, I will make a full confession. I have also done this, you know. Just argued about something on and on and on and on and on and on. So, but really, we should just not pay any attention. Just ignore it. Like Balaram just ignored this thing. And then Denuka did it again. And Balaram said, okay, let's finish this. So he took him by the hind leg and he just centrifugal force. Do you remember that from school? So this is centrifugal force and then right into the tree. And somehow these donkeys were different colors. I mean, I don't know, these demons are really fascinating. So this donkey was, these are different colors. And it looked like there were different colored clouds in the trees because Danica had his friends. By the way, you'll find that too. Like if you actually engage in an argument with somebody, you'll find that person has friends. So, you know, even if you defeat the first person, then more will come. And so more came. And then Krishna started to help. And they just... Of course, the demons were kind of heavy, so when they were in the trees sort of bent down. You know, and all these trees were sort of bending. Some of them fell over, like, and they were knocking over other trees. So it was just a mess. It was just a mess. And the demons were a little bloody, and there was blood got on the fruit. So the whole scene was just a mess, you know. The trees were broken and falling down, and it looked like different colored clouds in the trees, and then the fruits are falling down, and they were all covered with blood, so nobody wanted to eat them anyway. After all that of going there to get the fruits. So the acharyas say that nobody wanted to eat these bloody fruits. But the cowherd boys were very happy, you know, that Danica and his friends were killed. And the demigods were also very happy. So this particular pastime happened on Gopastami. And I also think about in Govinda Lilamrita, where Krishna Das Kaviraj tells the story that when Krishna started to take care of the cows, so Mother Yasoda said, I don't want you walking out in the forest barefoot. You know, you need to wear some shoes. Because every mother says this to the child, right? Hey, what are you doing going outside? You don't have any shoes, you don't have any jacket, right? So she says you need, of course in India you don't usually need a jacket, but you need an umbrella, and not for the rain, but for the sun. So she said you need shoes and you need an umbrella. And Krishna says, all right, mommy, I will wear shoes and an umbrella if you give all the cows also shoes and umbrellas. So this is also very interesting. Krishna's understanding of dharma, which of course is a supreme understanding of dharma. Dharma tu sakshat bhagavat pranita. What is dharma is what comes from God. So here Krishna is saying, the leader should not have more comfort than the person that they lead. It's not that the leader has great comfort and the followers suffer. He's saying, I'm the cow herder, but I should not have more pleasure than the cows. If the cows have to walk barefoot, of course it's a little interesting because cows have hooves, so they're not quite as affected as feet, and Krishna's feet are very, very soft. But this is one of the views of leadership. I regularly read books about leadership and management. It's one of my academic fields. And I was reading about companies that increased their profits versus companies that didn't. And one of the comparisons was companies where the leaders felt that their only business was to get more and more titles and more money and fancier offices, and companies where the leaders had the view of sharing the opulence with the employees. And those that had the view of sharing, they were more likely to prosper. And there were a lot of companies that even said, nobody gets a title unless it's absolutely necessary. If you can do your work without a title, you don't get a title. So this was Krishna's view. Krishna's view was, I'm not going to get something that the cow... He's talking about cows. He's talking about animals. He wasn't even talking about people. And cows who have hooves. You know. He says, this is our dharma. And Mother Yasoda didn't argue with him. She accepted. That's all right. Of course, there's not really any. I mean, the gopis are worried. The older gopis like Mother Yasoda, Mother Rohini, and the younger gopis like Radharani and Lalita, etc. They're worried that Krishna's feet are going to get pricked by thorns and pebbles. Now, if you go to Vrindavan today, you will find many, 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 many thorns and pebbles. But it's explained that when Krishna was appearing, that the paths were just soft and sandy, and there were not actually any thorns and pebbles. So we were also asked to talk a little bit about Govardhan, but I don't think we'll do that very much. Just simply that among the many places that Krishna and Balaram would herd the cows, there was certainly Govardhan Hill. Rupa Goswami explains in the Upadesha Amrita that of all of the places in Vrindavan, the best is Govardhan Hill, and of course the best place at Govardhan Hill is Radhakund. And Govardhan Hill in the spiritual world, it's a manifestation of the heart of the Lord. Actually comes from the heart of the Lord as a place requested by Srimati Radharani for the Lord's pleasure pastimes. And Govardhan Hill, particularly, of course, Govardhan Hill is Krishna himself, but in the mood of a devotee, something like how Lord Chaitanya is Krishna in the mood of a devotee. And Govardhan is serving everyone with his own body. He's serving everyone with his own body. He's the ultimate servant who just lies down on the ground and lets Krishna and the cows walk on him. So, materially speaking, if you let somebody walk on you, that's not very nice. Again, in America, we have that as an expression. Oh, he walked all over me. That means he really exploited me. He took advantage of me. But if you have Krishna and Balaram walking all over you, that's very nice. So Govardhan Hill is giving his own body for Krishna and Balaram to walk on, for them to sit on, caves for them to rest in, fruit trees, very soft roots, jewels just lying on the ground that Krishna, Balaram, and the cowherd boys, they just pick up and use to decorate their body, mineral pigments that they can use. They like to paint pictures on each other. This tendency we have even in this world to want to decorate our bodies, you know, because Krishna has this kind of enjoyment. And Govardhan Hill, of course, has many shade trees and waterfalls. Today you don't see any waterfalls on Govardhan Hill, but many, many waterfalls. And many places to hide and have wonderful pastimes with Krishna and the gopis, of course, playing there, as well as Krishna and the cowherd boys. So this Govardhan Hill is the highest place of Krishna's lila. So I think we will stop there. Again, Gopastami is tomorrow. And we have all these wonderful festivals. Srila Prabhupada told Tamal Krishna Maharaj that every Sunday we could have a special festival about one of Krishna's pastimes. And of course, in the spiritual world, every day is a festival. That's mentioned with Lord Varaha, that he returned to the spiritual world where every day is a festival. So it's very easy in our life to just get caught up in our day-to-day life. You know, okay, I've got to wake up, I've got to take a shower, I've got to brush my teeth, I've got to go to work, I've got to clean my house. But we should also be absorbed not just in what am I doing and what is my family doing and what are my friends doing, but what is Krishna doing? What is Krishna doing today? So any questions or comments or corrections or additions, subtractions? Yes.
Can I ask, I always was curious, what is the Dhanuka Sura with which Anartha represents?
Okay. So Balaram kills Dhanuka and Pralamba. Pralamba is passion, the mode of passion, and Dhanuka is the mode of ignorance. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that all the other demons are killed by Krishna, but these two, the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance, have to actually be killed by the devotee themselves with the help of the guru. And then when the devotee kills them by following the instructions of the guru, because Balaram is the supreme guru, then the heart is cleaned for the appearance of Krishna. So that is a deep subject matter. Which, as it is 8:17, I do not know if we have time to get into or not. You say yes. But it's always difficult when you ask people, should I talk more? No one ever says no. So even if they actually want you to be quiet so that they can go take their prasadam or go to sleep, they never say. They never say. So it's a little difficult to ask that question because there's some social pressure to say yes. If ever I say, do you want to hear it? Everybody, oh, yes, yes. And even the people are thinking, oh, I wish you'd be quiet now. It's not. They also say yes. So is there anything else?
Wondering, for example, this Govinda Lilamrita of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, these pastimes that are described there, is he describing them from his own experience, or is he, trying to describe them more elaborately, like they're described in Bhagavatam?
That is a very interesting question. I cannot say I know what is the answer. But it's not just Krishnadas Kaviraj, but many of our acharyas have written books that take the pastimes which are described in, say, Srimad Bhagavatam and greatly expand upon them. You have Kavi Karnapur who did that in the Ananda Vrindavan Champu, Jiva Goswami who does that in the Gopal Champu. And then you have other books that really tell something that's not directly in the Bhagavatam. So Govinda Lilamrita and by Krishnadas Kaviraj, and then Kavi Karnapur has Krishnaika Kumudi. Those books both describe the Astakalila Lila, the eightfold pastimes of Krishna on a particular day. So Rupa Goswami, of course, refers to the Astakalila Lila in his Upadesh Amrita. So Govinda Lilamrita and Krishna Kanaika Kumudi, they're not describing the occasional pastimes of Krishna in the material world exactly. They're describing Krishna's eternal pastimes in eight parts of the day and even divided into smaller portions of the day. So they're describing the eternal lila. And then you have other books. You have, like Raghunath Das Goswami has Mukta Charita, which is the pearl pastime, which is, again, not discussed at all in Bhagavatam. I mean, and then you have, say, Vidagdha Madhava and Lalita Madhava of Rupa Goswami, which, again, I mean, Rupa Goswami has this elaborate description in Lalita Madhava of how all of Krishna's queens are really gopis who either, you know, came to Mathura or died and then came down again from the heavenly planets and so on, which again, these stories are not in the Bhagavatam. You know, so very, very elaborate stories. And then you have, say, Sanatana Goswami's Brihad Bhagavatamrita, which is the whole story of Gopal Kumar. And I had assumed for a long time that it was a fictional story like the Paranjana story. But I remember asking Gopi Parandana Prabhu about it when he was translating it. And he said, I don't see anything in Sanatana Goswami's book that would lead me to conclude it's a fictional story. He said, I'm assuming that it's a historically correct story. So where do they get these stories from? The answer is, I don't know. Now, one thing that we need to keep in mind with these books from our acharyas from an academic perspective is that people in other sampradayas probably do not accept these books the way that we accept. So we accept that Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, Krishna Das Kaviraj, Kavi Karnapur are describing things that are accurately true according to their realization. That these are realized souls, that they have their, like rishis, who can see the reality, and they're describing, like Krishna describes the gurus, tattva-darshinaha. They're actually seeing the truth. And frankly, even the Shastra itself, I mean, if you're going to talk about the Bhagavatam, what is the Bhagavatam? It's really the words of various rishis and acharyas. And, you know, they often do refer, okay, well, what I'm telling you, I have heard from such and such person who's heard from such and such person. But in many cases also there, we're really reading their realizations. And what's accepted as Shastra is not the same in every sampradaya, yes? So there's certain books that are accepted as Shastra by all the followers of the Vedas. So all the four Vaishnava sampradayas, the followers of Sankaracharya, you know, the Shaktas, the Shaivites, certain scriptures, everyone accepts, like the four Vedas, for example. And then there are certain scriptures that are only accepted in certain sampradayas, and not others, or that are accepted as supreme. I mean, although we accept that all 18 Puranas are authoritative, we don't study all of them, right? You know, some of them say that Lord Shiva is supreme, yes? So we don't accept those. And then even within the Vaishnava Sampradayas, we may accept, for example, that the songs of the Alwars are bona fide, but do we really study them? Do we study them? No. And in the same way, the people in the Sri Sampradaya, they're not studying the books of our Gaudiya Acharyas. Does this make sense to everybody? I mean, even within the Gaudiya Sampradaya, you know, there's different branches. You go to Vrindavan, there's the branch coming from Shamananda Pandit. They wear a little different tilak. And they have some different acharyas in their line. People that in ISKCON we've never even heard of, and we would never quote them. And the same, you go to Manipur, where they're followers of Narottama Das Thakur, and you'll find the same thing. And it even gets to the point that within our specific branch, within our branch coming from Bhakti Vinod to Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati to our Srila Prabhupada, Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati had many other disciples. And if you ever visit a Gaudiya Math temple, you'll find that they quote from there. Again, people we don't know of in ISKCON. So they'll quote from Prabhupada's godbrothers, and we're thinking, who is this person? I don't know who they are. And people who are the disciples of those persons, they will take their realizations as supreme. And it was interesting. I remember one time many, many years ago, someone gave me something written by someone who's in another branch of the Gaudiya Math. And this person was giving their realizations about Govardhan Hill, and I thought, well, I've never read this in any scripture. You know, where are these coming from? And I asked this person's followers, where are these coming from? And they said, oh, it's his own realization. And I thought, well, for his disciples, that's authoritative. But for us, it's not authoritative. So, of course, people like Rupa Goswami and Krishna Das Kaviraj are accepted as authoritative by all the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. I mean, you have also Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. He, in his purport, say in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Bhagavatam, he adds all kinds of details. You notice that? He adds dialogue. At Purnachandra Maharaj, he made this Gitamrita, where he took the purports of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and he wove it into the verses. So he's telling the Bhagavad Gita, referencing Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purports, which adds a whole lot of dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna that aren't in the original verses. So this is a question of whether or not one has faith in one's particular acharyas. I mean, that's basically what it boils down to. Is that all right? But mostly they don't say. I mean, I don't. It doesn't say. They often don't say, you know, where did I get this from? Where is this story from? Sometimes they give reference. I heard it from this person, or, you know, it comes from this particular place. But some of these stories they're just telling. I mean, the way, then also we have a tendency that's growing in ISKCON, which I find worrisome, that we repeat as authoritative stories of Krishna that are not from any of our acharyas, that are just kind of folklore in India. This is becoming a very common trend. And even I saw one book published by an ISKCON temple, not just published by an individual, that had many stories about Krishna without saying where any of them were from. And it just said in the back of the book, you know, these stories are from all different scriptures and from, you know, village tradition. Now, sometimes Prabhupada will also quote from village tradition, but he'll note that, so he might say in his purport that according to village tradition, there's this, I can't remember offhand, there's this particular story. I personally take those with a huge grain of salt, and unless I've heard that directly from Prabhupada or the acharyas, I don't repeat them. That's my personal standard. And I try to be wary of even hearing them. So I try to avoid even hearing about them. So, at one time I went to one class. I was actually ordered by my GBC to go to one class of some visiting preacher in our community. He said, "Urmila, I want you to go see what's going on." So I sort of went as a spy, sort of kind of. But they knew I was there as a spy. It wasn't so serious. Anyway, so the person was telling all these stories, and at one point I asked the speaker, "Where are you getting your stories from?" He wouldn't answer me. I asked over and over again, you know, for like an hour. And I tried to be very polite about it, although that's not my strong suit, but I tried. And I didn't get an answer. And I remember the next day, one of the other leaders of the community also went on the order of the GBC. And after 3 hours of asking, he got an answer. You know. It's village talk. As he says, village talk. He said, "I go around Vrindavan and I talk to the villagers and I collect their stories. And then I come back to the West. Oh, I have new stories for you." You know, that's not in the scripture. So, at least me personally, the way I was trained in ISKCON when I first joined is I don't want to hear those, and I certainly don't want to repeat them. I don't want to hear them because then I might repeat them. That's a very long answer, but I hope that that's all right. Yes?
Thank you for this answer. I just wanted to relate to his question, and my question is regarding Shruti and Smriti. Mm. And the question is, if his self-realized wishes tell certain realization or story, is that a Shruti or a Smriti?
It depends where it is. Generally, the realization of the rishis is in the smriti, generally. The shruti is said to be directly from the breathing of Narayana.
And then why is our Bhagavad Gita considered a smriti, not a shruti?
Because it's coming directly from Krishna? Because he's actually speaking, did you say?
Then it should be shruti, no?
It should be, yes. Of course, we take it as equal to Shruti because Krishna is speaking. But it's the Bhagavad Gita, although we have it as a separate book, it's really part of the Mahabharata, which is in the whole different category of just itihasa. The Mahabharata isn't even one of the Puranas. Of course, it's interesting that Bhagavad Gita is probably one of the most accepted books among any of the followers of the Vedic religion. So even though it's part of the Mahabharata, and even though it's not one of the Puranas, and it's not one of the four Vedas, Bhagavad Gita is definitely one of the most accepted books, widely accepted, among all the different schools and all the different followers. Yes.
I would just like to share one comment, commentary about, I was listening to Guru John Prabhu lecture 2 days ago, and it's a little bit connected to these answers that I think that it was Kavi Karnapura about the book Ananda Vrindavan Champu, and he said, Kavi, he said that he wrote that book for his enjoyment, so you can criticize as much you want.
Well, that's interesting, because Krishna Das Kaviraj also says that even about Chaitanya Charitamrita. That's interesting. Of course, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Das Kaviraj does very clearly say, this is coming from the diaries of Swarup Damodar and Raghunath Das Goswami. And Raghunath Das Goswami moved from Jagannath Puri to Radhakund. You can go even now, I mean, it's right by Shamakund now, but you can go to Krishna Das Kaviraj's Bhajan Kutir, and right next to there is Raghunath Das Goswami's Bhajan Kutir. And that's where Krishna Das Kaviraj wrote the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he would meet with Raghunath Das Goswami every afternoon for about 4 hours. And Raghunath Das Goswami would tell him the leelas of the Lord that he personally witnessed or that were taken from the diary of Swarup Damodar. And that was used as a basis for his book. But then you also have these other books where they don't give that. They just tell the story. Krishna was in Dwarka, and he's talking to Satyabhama, and Satyabhama said, I heard that in Vrindavan one time, pearls grew on plants instead of from oysters. Can you tell me the story? And Krishna tells her the story, and there's no source whatsoever given. Of course, our ultimate evidence is Pratyaksha Avagamam Dharma. Our ultimate evidence is our own realization, frankly. Therefore, Krishna says, Rajaguyam, Rajavijaya Rajaguyam, Pavitram Idam Uttamam, Pratyaksha Bhagavam Dharmam, Susukam Kartam Avinyam. I mean, even if we're going to talk about the Shruti, I mean, let's be real here. How do we know? How do you know? How can you say, I know this book was breathed at the beginning of creation by God? How do you know that? Can you know that? I mean, can you even know about the history of Slovenia? You know, how old is this country anyway? Not very old. But if you want to go way back, you know, if you want to go back, like European history 2,000 years ago, how do you know? 24
years.
How do you, 24 years old? Oh my God, that's why you're babies. So how do you know? You know, if you're going to look at history 2,000 years ago, how are you going to know that you're getting an accurate report? Can you know? Can you talk to anybody who was here 2,000 years ago? I mean, come on, look at the news we get from today. How do you know it's true? God. Seriously. I mean, we had the funniest thing. In Detroit, when we opened a restaurant, so we had two news broadcasts by the same news agency, NBC. One was local and one was national. It was the same company, NBC. And one of them said, because you have to understand it a little bit, so the temple was right on the edge of different neighborhoods. So 10 blocks in one direction was a very bad neighborhood. You know, broken glass, graffiti, crime. And literally, 10 blocks in the other direction was one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the United States. Grosse Pointe Park, something like Beverly Hills. So just 10 blocks in either direction. And right where the temple was kind of lower middle class. But the temple had been the mansion of a very, very wealthy man. So it had formerly been a wealthy area, had gone down that far. So one of the broadcasts said, when you think of wonderful and old neighborhoods, this one comes to mind. And they took pictures of the beautiful mansions 10 blocks in the one direction. And they said, and the Hare Krishnas are ruining everything by bringing in a commercial restaurant. And then the other broadcast took pictures of the broken glass and the graffiti in the other direction. They said, when you think of how the city is falling apart, you think of this neighborhood, and the Hare Krishnas are going to bring order and stability by having this restaurant. And it was completely opposite. It was the same company, just one was the, I forget which was the local and which was the national. but it was just fascinating. And I remember after seeing that, I decided you can never trust the news. No, you just cannot trust the news. Depending which one we watch, you'd get a completely different perspective. So how do we know? How do we know? And if you want to get really bad, my dear friends, how do I know what I'm perceiving is correct? I mean, I can't trust what the newscasters tell me about what's happening today and what they focus on. I mean, this thing with Ebola is so funny. There's like so many people dying every day of malaria, you know. There's like 3 people dying of Ebola. So I can't trust the newscasters. I can't trust the historians. I can't even trust myself. Do you know that what you perceive is real? I mean, do you know? Okay, I can touch it. All right, but I touch things in my dreams, too. And when I'm in my dream, I think they're real, yes? How do I know that this is real? Well, because there's a whole bunch of you all having the same experience, and you all say it's real, but maybe we're all illusioned. That's entirely possible. It's entirely possible. Look, we can sit in a movie theater and all watch the same movie and all be illusioned as a group. Yes? Or we can play a computer game. All of us can play the same computer game and enter into the same fantasy world and have some group illusion. Isn't that a fact? So just because everyone in this room agrees that these are cartels and I'm holding them, does that mean it's true? We have no way to know. We don't know. We don't know. I'm serious. My only evidence for truth is it seems to be true to my senses and other people agree with me. Other people confirm, yes, you're holding the card. Okay, must be true. That's how I know a dream isn't true. That's the only way I know a dream isn't true. And it's shorter. But it's the only way. You know, I have a dream about you. I have a dream that I'm taking prasadam with you. And I tell you and you say, well, I didn't have that experience. So how do we know anything's true? This is a problem. It's a problem. So the only ultimate evidence is our own experience and our own transformation. Therefore, Krishna says, Raja Vijaya Raja Guya. The king of knowledge is Pavitram. It purifies you. It purifies you. You'll experience purification. Pratyaksha, you will experience it directly. And susukham, you'll become very, very happy. So, and it is interesting that when a person gains enlightenment and gains Krishna consciousness, almost always they will say things like, wow, this is actually real. So our only ultimate way of knowing something is real is that. Raja Vijaya Raja Yam Pavitram Idamucham Prachaksha Agamam Dharmyam. He also says it's Dharma. If you want Dharma, mean the essence of what is reality. So therefore, Prabhupada says, ultimately you have to fly your own plane. You can get help on the ground, you get hit, you know, so much. But ultimately, one has to fly one's own plane. One has to not lick the outside of the honey jar. One has to have an actual experience and see Krishna for oneself and see the lilas for oneself and enter into them for oneself. That is, there's no other ultimate test. Otherwise, we can always have some doubt. But you have to do something. You can't just say, well, be an agnostic and say, well, I don't believe anybody, I don't believe that. Well, what are you going to do? Just freeze? You know, what are you going to do? Okay, I won't do anything because I don't know what's real, what's not. The agnostics have to act, yes? If someone's an agnostic, they have to act, they have to do something. Agnosticism is a very impractical philosophy. So we decide what to believe based on what makes the most reasonable sense to us and based on our own practical experiences. Is that all right? Sorry to shake you. these kinds of questions. At least we have reasonable truth claims. I mean, there's a lot of religions that don't even make a reasonable truth claim. They'll just say, you know, our founder just sat down and made up a new religion. At least we have claims of parampara, yes? We can trace back reasonably historical. I think we should end now. Go past me and keep the jam.